So far in the session this morning, we've sort of had this progression going from septic tanks, septic systems, to more sort of whole watershed type things. And so we're interested in looking at the uptake of specifically pharmaceuticals into crops that are irrigated with these, with low concentrations of these compounds. This is a figure from the National Academy of Sciences. And if you look at this, what this is showing is sort of water use in the United States since the 1950s. And the thing that's interesting to look at here is you have population going up. So the dotted lines are sort of projections, and the solid lines are from actual data. You have per capita water use in gallons per person per day sort of going down, starting in about the mid-1980s. And then you have population continuing to grow. And then down here we see, if I can get, U.S. water reuse. And when we look at water reuse, there's a lot of different things we can think of as water reuse. The first one that always comes to people's mind is sort of the idea that came about in the early 90s in San Diego, which was direct potable reuse. A lot of people in San Diego had a problem with that, with they looking at the idea of taking effluent, treating it with a lot of advanced technology, but treating it and then putting it back into the sewer, into the drinking water system. People weren't real happy about that. The interesting part is if you go from that early 1990s to today that's probably the most thought of idea. People are saying the best thing for us to do with water reuse to increase our water supply is to take wastewater from a sewer treatment plant, treat it, and put it directly back into the potable supply. So here's an example. And so because of that, we think of that as being reuse. If you take, it never leaves the pipe, you keep it in the pipe and use it again. But in essence, as the National Academy has pointed out, what we have is kind of de facto reuse. And if you look at this, you have a sewer treatment plant here where you can take wastewater, and all these purple arrows are direct reuse. So you're taking water from a sewer treatment plant, you're putting it in a pipe, and you're putting it back into the city to use for irrigation. You use it for things like flushing toilets. There's lots of things that at this point we use, as well as we could look at using it, treating it to a high level, and then reusing it for potable reuse. You can take it and use it for factories. A good example of that is in the Phoenix area, we have the nation's largest nuclear power plant, and approximately 100 million gallons a day of wastewater from the sewer treatment plants in the Phoenix area get sent directly to Palo Verde, and they use it for, in essence, cooling. You can get things where you add it to streams, or using it for irrigation on farms. So those are all really direct reuse. You then, here in number four, you can have a recharge basin. In Arizona, we do a lot of that, where you take treated effluent, it's been tertiary treated, you put it on a spreading basin, and you allow that spreading basin to infiltrate to groundwater. And there are areas where we've actually raised groundwater from, say, over 25 years, from, say, 150 feet below ground surface to now groundwater is about 130 feet below ground surface. So we're actually raising our water tables there in Arizona through this managed recharge of treated effluent. But then when we talk about de facto reuse, in essence, you take this effluent, you typically, in more humid areas, you deposit it in a stream. That stream moves down, it goes downstream. And without any further treatment, you then withdraw that water and use it for something else. Well, you may have diluted it, but you haven't done much more treatment to that water. So, in essence, as the National Academy has defined it, that's de facto reuse. You're taking this water and reusing it again. This has happened, in essence, since people have been around. But now we're concentrating the water, we're putting in streams, we're diminishing the streams by withdrawals of water. So the ratio of effluent to the diluting water is narrowing. This isn't a new use. So here's a from 1908. This is from the museum, the Utah Historical Society, and this shows in 1908. This is non-treated sewage water being put into a canal in Salt Lake City and then irrigated on farms. Now, there is a reason you did this. As we've learned earlier, there's a lot of nutrients in this water. So this actually increased your productivity. The difference between then and now are the other compounds we're putting in the water, whether it be, as we talked about earlier, nonphenols, heavy metals, or pharmaceuticals. So here's an example of de facto water use kind of taken to the extreme. This is Phoenix. And right here is a river. If you follow it like that, and you see, and the one thing that you notice about that river, there's no water in it. There's a little bit of water right here. That's a man-made lake in the river that the city of Tempe pumps groundwater up to the surface so that there's a place to go swim and boat and see things like that along the river. If you've ever flown into Phoenix Airport, here's the airport right here. You'll have flown over Tempe Town Lakes. So this river, at some times, can run with as high of flows. The highest flow that's been there has been about 500,000 CFS. So during floods, this is a big river. But during most of the time, it's a dry river. So where this box is, if you look, we're going to kind of blow it up. This is a sewer treatment plant. And if you look right below that river, or right below the sewer treatment plant, here, upstream, no water. Downstream, there's now water. If you go downstream from this sewer treatment plant, so in essence, there's direct water reuse happening there for stream flow. This stream is just effluent. Downstream from this sewer treatment plant is the Buckeye Irrigation District that takes water out of it, the city of Gila Bend, eventually the Colorado River, the city of Yuma, and all of this water that can make it past irrigation ends up in rivers downstream. But most of that water gets reused for irrigation. So we wanted to look at seeing what would happen if we took these drugs, can we get them to be taken up into crops? And there's been work done on drugs into crops, but one unique aspect of the work we wanted to look at is what would the effect of water depletion be on the uptake? And if you think about water depletion, in essence, all of the data I show you will have had the same total amount of water applied. The plants were never water stressed. What the difference is the amount to which we allow the soil moisture to deplete before we replenish it. And that's the three depletion levels. And then we used three drug concentrations. The drug concentrations were a concentration that was about similar to what you would find in sewage effluent. And then we went 10 times higher. Well, no, we went 5 times higher. No, 1, 5, and 25. So it was 5 times higher and 25 times higher. The three drugs we chose. Atenolol. It's a beta blocker. It's used for heart disease, hypertension. It lowers high blood pressure. And it's found a lot in the environment. One thing to notice here is that solubility is really high, 13.3 grams per liter. That's a very soluble drug. And the pKa of 9.6. The second drug we looked at was ofloxacin. It's an antibiotic. The solubility, 28.3 milligrams per liter. So now we're, orders of magnitude lower in solubility. And the pKa about 5.4 to 6.2. Lastly, diclofenac. It's an NSAID, which is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. It's similar to ibuprofen, aspirin. This is an analgesic and an anti-inflammatory that is widely prescribed. Its solubility is 2.37 milligrams per liter. So again, another reduction in solubility and a very low pKa. Now, all of these three drugs have been shown to both environmentally or affect organisms at environmental concentrations, fish, and other invertebrates that live in the waters that it's in. And that's one of the reasons we chose these, is that we wanted to make sure we had something that was environmentally relevant and at relevant concentrations. So our experimental setup was, we took these tubs, and we put, there's a soil moisture sensor in each tub. And that soil moisture sensor not only senses moisture on a volumetric content basis, but it also will turn on the irrigation clock and then irrigate. So in essence, we could look at our three different soil depletion levels. So what we did is our volumetric water content for these soils was about 30%. We allowed depletion of 7%, we allowed depletion of 10%, and we allowed depletion of 14%. And once it hit that depletion level, then we irrigated and we refilled all the pores. We used a very, very fine sand. And the reason we did this is because we wanted to sort of minimize any effects that organic carbon might have. So if you had soils with a lot of organic carbon, you could get some sorption of the compounds onto the organic carbon and it not be available for the plants to uptake. So if we use these sands, it's sort of our worst case scenario. This is the worst possible outcome for these drugs. We also in every tub we had a soil moisture sensor that could turn on the irrigation, turn off the irrigation. However, in a few of the tubs, we put in, we actually measured the matrix potential of the soil to make sure that we had sort of our volumetric water content and soil matrix potential tracked itself. To irrigate, in these tubs, we had aqueous nutrient solution that would feed a continual nutrient solution at very low concentrations. So you could kind of think of this as a mixture between hydroponics and growing in the soil. And the reason we needed the soil there was so that you could get this depletion. And the reason the depletion is important is that the water around the roots becomes more concentrated. When you think about evapotranspiration, you start to evaporate the soil moisture. And so from, say, 28 to 14% volumetric water concentration, you just concentrated the solution around the roots twice. So that's allowing the plant to experience these kind of fluctuating higher concentrations of the drug. So we planted the plants, irrigated. And you can see here that we had good growth. And today I'm going to mostly talk about, I'm only going to talk today about Swiss chard. And that was a leafy vegetable. It was the one we started with because we knew that any drug that was there that flowed with the water would be in the Swiss chard because it would, unless the plant could actually exclude it. So here's some data. First is, we also, underneath some of the tubs, we had load cells. So we could actually measure the total amount of water that was there. So we had a really good handle on making sure, first off, that our soil moisture sensors were working properly. We could get exact mass of water that was ET'd. And if you look here, so the red is volumetric water content. So we planted here. We start irrigating. And you can see here now that the load cell is showing you that, yes, you're adding the water, water contents. The load cell saying the actual mass of water is tracking what the soil moisture sensors say, but you can also see here that now you're starting to get plant growth, and so this mass begins to move up, because that's the plants fixing carbon and growing. So once we had the plants, we needed to figure out how to get the compound out. So we did an extraction procedure using an accelerated solvent extractor. The best extraction method we could come up with to make sure we got all the drug out is we used a 25-75 ratio of methanol to methylene chloride. We would use a static of 10 minutes at 50 degrees C. The pressure was 1,500 psi, and down here you can see what we would get out of the cells. And if you look, the one thing about it you notice is that some of the extractions were, depending on the plant, didn't have a lot of stuff in them. But if you look, the Swiss chard is here on the end, and it's very dark green. There's a lot of chlorophyll in there. There's a lot of protein, sugars, a real mess for trying to do chromatography. So to clean it up even further, we would take what we extracted after it was freeze-dried, we'd evaporate to dryness, we'd reconstitute in methanol, and then we would dilute it with water so that it was a maximum 3% solvent. Once it was that dilute, we could then pass it through solid phase extraction, extract the drugs we were interested in off, allow a lot of the contaminants to pass through, then we would elute off with 3 mL of methylene chloride, evaporate that to dryness, and then reconstitute that in 0.5 mL of methanol water. That should be 50-50. For detection, we used LC-MS-MS that, using an Xterra, a Waters Xterra column. Our mobile phase was acetonitrile and water, and it was a 10-minute runtime. So what I show here is this. This is a standard showing where ofloxacin, atenolol, and diclofenac come out. We had good chromatography, good separations. These are just three representative chromatograms. And the thing that's important to see here is that you saw how messy our original matrix was. And there was a concern as to whether we were going to be able to actually detect the compound in that matrix. Well, you can see we did do a good job of cleaning up the matrix, as well as you can definitely see we have detection, we have the right retention times, and we were looking at specific MRM patterns, so we're looking at specific parent-daughter ions. The other thing to notice here is that we have ofloxacin, we have atenolol in the plants, but we had no diclofenac. So the diclofenac was just not going into the plants. We didn't really detect diclofenac in anything. We had a few hits, but upon further inspection, we realized that they had been contaminants. We went back, got clean sample, ran them again, and we had no diclofenac. So here's sort of the take-home message from this, and that is that for atenolol, now use the 7% depletion, 10% depletion, and 14% depletion. Those are, again, we've allowed 7% of the moisture to go away. We've refilled that 7% of the pore space, allowed 7% to go away again. We've refilled that 7% of the pore space, as well as 10 and 14. The thing that's interesting with atenolol to look at is, really, there's not huge differences in concentration between the 1 and the 5 parts per billion. But when you go to that 14% depletion, all of a sudden you get this huge increase in the amount of compound that's being taken up. So, and that's across the board. So what that really tells us is probably happening is there's some sort of mechanism the plant has to exclude these compounds, or there's some passive mechanism going on at the root surface or somewhere where there's sorption that's happening that's preventing these compounds from going in at the lower concentration, or when you've irrigated more frequently. When you don't and you allow that concentration to build up to a certain level, now you get breakthrough. And this is for Swiss chard. With ofloxacin, it's a different story. It's sort of, at 5 and 25, it looks like there might be an effect of soil moisture depletion, but not a huge effect at the environmentally relevant concentration of 1 part per billion. So, what does this tell us? Well, ofloxacin was taken up more than atenolol, which was taken up at a greater amount than diclofenac. Diclofenac we really didn't find. The thing that's interesting about it is that the ofloxacin uptake might be related to the pH. The soil pH and the water pH that we were using was around 6. So with the pKa being, I couldn't find anybody who had done actual experimental pKa determination. It was all modeled. So with a pKa between 5.5 and 6.4, you're looking at a situation where you're right there at that transition between where you might have the neutral compound or a charged compound. And if, as soon as it becomes charged, it becomes much more soluble, much easier to take up. And there's some, especially since we had no CEC in this soil. And so that may be why ofloxacin had a higher concentration. Now, atenolol was the only one that really showed effect of the soil moisture depletion. So what this shows is that we're in a position now where we need to go from the environmental side and start looking at plant physiology, trying to figure out, is there something in the plant physiology that's allowing this, the concentrating effect of the atenolol to kind of have this breakthrough. So with that, I'd like to thank USDA NEPA for funding this project, and with that, I'll take any questions.